Let's bring you connections. And our connection this hour was made when the governor announced that the state would mandate the wearing of facial coverings, masks, cloth coverings to guard against spreading the coronavirus. Many citizens were already making changes on their own, wearing facial coverings on walks or in stores. And Governor Cuomo says it was important for the state to put its weight behind that change. Now, interestingly, if you go back about 8-9 days, the governor adopted some rather libertarian language in that news conference. He was asked if people would be thrown in jail for not wearing a facial covering. The governor said no. He said the state can't force people to do much of anything. State can't force you to stay in your homes or not gather in crowds or to wear masks. Ultimately, the governor said people will wear facial coverings not because they're ordered to do it, but because they know it's the right thing to do. And if they don't, the governor predicted that their fellow New Yorkers would shame them. No need for handcuffs or police to step in. As countries around the world deal with COVID-19, governments are taking different steps to try to get the public on board with changing behaviors. Beach and business closures, masking, physical distancing. And a national survey finds that the pandemic seems to be bridging some typical partisan divides. Researchers asked more than 3,000 Americans different questions about possible policies to combat the virus. Travel bans, punishing speech that's inaccurate about the virus or dangerous, and the like. They found that there were strong majorities across political and age demographics supporting many of the measures, even restrictions on speech. But will support for government action eventually erode? What do we know about what the public is willing to tolerate? Our guests are here to discuss it, and one of the authors of that study is Kevin Cope, who's a professor of law and public policy at the University of Virginia School of Law. He's on the line with us. Professor, welcome. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure, Evan.
And Lauren Hall is with us, a professor of political science in the College of Liberal Arts at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Professor Hall, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to ask you the same question that Tom Gelton from NPR asked, because this context will matter. Why don't you take us through the process and how long ago you were surveying? Because, you know, certainly we're going to see attitudes probably evolve during a pandemic or maybe some patients fray, but take us through what you found and when you started that process.
Right. So we started this study about 5 weeks ago, so early to mid-March. And this was right when countries in Europe were just beginning to put in to play some of the most restrictive measures. And at that point, there was beginning to be a national conversation here in the U.S. about how we would react. And of course, we knew that the policy choices that were made in the U.S. could mean the difference between many thousands of U.S. deaths on the low end, or hundreds, or even hundreds of thousands, or even millions on the upper end, right? And we assumed, my colleagues and I, by the way, it was with Adam Chilton, Charles Crabtree, and Mila Versteeg, we assumed that there'd be big disagreements over what policies to implement, like there are in so many other things in this country. And certainly there would be disagreement on what policies the government had the power to implement under the Constitution. You know, things like political party, maybe even age, given the disparate impact of the virus. And of course, if this were true, it would have big ramifications for what sort of restrictions could actually be implemented. We might see people subject to very different restrictions just based on the politics and the political leanings of the leadership in their state or local municipality. But that's, as you said, that's not what we found.
Okay, and so you found a lot of, I would say, just looking at some of the numbers and looking at what's been published, not a whole lot of disagreement, at least at the time of your survey, among parties. Essentially, a vote in favor of the government taking some measures that normally we would not give the thumbs up to. Fair to say?
That's right.
Okay. So even speech. This was the one that surprised me the most, Professor. Even speech was on that list.
That's right. We found that overall 70% of our sample was willing to support a policy that would restrict certain speech that might have public adverse public health consequences, is how we phrased it. So it seems clear that a lot of the speech described in a policy like that would be protected under the Constitution. You could imagine people going online and saying, you know, this isn't such a big deal, we shouldn't be social distancing, it's an exaggeration. Or you can imagine on the other side, people taking a more extreme view and causing a panic about what people should do. And so, you know, those might have public health consequences. And so we had 70% of people say that they would support that. Of course, we haven't seen those policies enacted in the United States. We did see it in places like China, where people were punished for disseminating information that was contrary to the government's view, but not in this country.
Okay. And before I turn to Professor Hall, a couple of other points here. When it comes to the way the public is debating sort of reopening or a phased reopening of the economy versus protecting against for public health, sometimes it's kind of dichotomized in that way. And there have been other kind of polls or surveys that aren't, I don't think, as granular as yours. But in all the polls, NBC did one about 10 days ago. There's been a number of others. All the polls I've seen indicate a strong majority preference. When you ask questions like, is it more important to reignite the economy or to continue to be patient and guard for public health? Now, that is a broad question, but every poll still finds strong majorities, despite the protests we've seen, in favor of public health. But do you think that there is any evidence so far that what you found in your work starting 5 weeks ago is starting at all to feel outdated, or do you view it as, you know, is it interesting for a slice in time? Do you think it will be lasting? How do you view that question?
It certainly is a slice in time. You know, with COVID-19, people are affected by the news cycle. They're affected by if they see people around them who are infected or who even are dying or in the hospital. And they, you know, they're affected by what other people think. So no doubt these numbers are different if we were to redo this today. You know, if we had done it and had the foresight somehow to do it 2 months ago, I suspect we would have seen much lower numbers if we had, say, asked them about a hypothetical pandemic or whatnot. And if we did them, you know, two months from now or 2 years from now, assuming that the virus is behind us then, I suspect they'd be lower again. But I think they do tell us about how people make these decisions in the midst of a crisis, and that people are willing, I think, to shift their views when they're afraid, when their safety is compromised. And that might generalize outside of a pandemic to things like threats of terrorism or threats of crime generally.
And you might say there's no atheist in a foxhole, and your views change in the moment. And just for listeners who might be thinking, okay, well, this survey, though, if there was really that much agreement across partisan lines, it must have fumbled the methodology. But look at this number in the same survey. 88% of Republicans said that they did approve of the president's handling of the coronavirus, 34% of Democrats. This was not just a sort of a skewed sample. This is a pretty wide sample. You feel pretty good about the sample, Professor.
Right. And, you know, the way that we do these surveys and working with a firm is they make sure that it's representative on a number of demographic qualities, including political party and age and several others. So when you see numbers like 34% of Democrats supporting President Trump's handling and 88% of Republicans, you may think, well, that's because Republicans like a more aggressive policy. I'm sorry, that Democrats like a more aggressive policy and Republicans would like a more laissez-faire or a wait-and-see attitude at that point. But in reality, that's not what we find, because the rest of our data show that people are more or less unified on the actual policies. So this is probably just another reflecting the bias of people to, you know, toward or against President Trump generally.
All right, Professor Hall, what do you take away from at least this survey, and then we'll speak more generally about what the public is willing to tolerate and what's effective kind of policy?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the results aren't terribly surprising, especially given the time frame in which they came out. I think what we find is that, generally speaking, in times of emergency, we certainly saw this after 9/11, as certainly after a variety of different kinds of natural disasters, for example. People's toleration for increased government activity and increased individual restrictions tends to be very high. And so there's a sort of circle the bandwagons, or circle the wagons, rather, kind of approach. I do think it would be fascinating to see how this survey would come out now, because I think what is changing is people are starting to see the economic impacts are becoming more clear. And so what seemed like a sort of temporary sacrifice for the common good 5 weeks ago, now I think people are really sort of buckling under the strain. I think there's more conflicting information out there about the pros and cons of lockdowns versus the way that other countries have handled things in terms of, for example, mandatory quarantines. The obvious failure of our testing regime, I think, has caused people to distrust sort of broad government action in a variety of ways. But I certainly think that initial survey response makes a lot of sense to me as a political scientist, given how we see people respond in emergencies all the time. There's usually a very strong leaning toward decisive government action during those times.
And so let me follow up with this, Professor Hall. I've been reading the writer and researcher based in Hong Kong named Lyman Stone, an American living there, and he's been writing a lot lately about lockdowns. He actually thinks that that term really needs description. I mean, in his view, given the fact that China has done different things than Korea has done, and Germany has done different things than the United States has done, his view of a lockdown is the kind of situation where you've got to be in your home and you've got to basically stop at a checkpoint and explain a reason if you're going to leave your home. Beyond that, he thinks that, you know, physical distancing guidelines or even sort of government orders, probably not quite a lockdown. School closures, he wouldn't put in the category of lockdown. So, I mean, I think his point is twofold. Number one, let's be specific about language. But then he says, from the research that he has gathered from different countries, government mandated action hasn't worked all that well. And what he means by that is people generally are taking action on their own, absent a government mandate, and the mandates don't actually change much of the outcomes. He points in this country to the fact that in mid-March, a week before a lot of government-ordered closures of restaurants, for example, restaurant reservations were already down 90%. The public saw mm-hmm. the pandemic, and the public was not interested in going out to eat in crowds, even without a government order. So his view is, you know, don't put the weight of the state behind something if people are already making decisions on their own, and allow the public to have information about a pandemic, but to largely make decisions on their own. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I actually had the pleasure to, I was at a symposium with Dr. Stone in November before all of this happened. And so I got the chance to talk with him on separate demographic issues. But so I've actually been following some of his writing with interest. And I think he's largely right. He understands the sort of quantitative piece probably more than I do as someone who focuses more on qualitative or political theory questions. But what I saw certainly in anecdotally was that many people were already ahead of the government actions. There were people who were already pulling their students, their children out of schools. I remember on a few of the mom pages that I'm on Facebook, people were already pulling their children out the Friday before the announcement was made on Monday to close the schools in New York State. So I think that we do see that people are getting ahead. I think that the other thing that I think is interesting about Dr. Stone's analysis is looking at, for example, the way that social norms play a really important role in how successful a lot of these kinds of behaviors end up being. So he looked at, for example, mask wearing. He lives in Hong Kong. Mask wearing is a very strong cultural norm throughout Asia. And it's part of the sort of communitarian approach that a lot of Asian countries take, which is mask wearing is not done for your sake. It's not done to prevent you from catching anything. It's done so that you don't inadvertently spread the disease to other people. And now that we know more about the rise of, or rather the asymptomatic spread, mask wearing turns out to be a very important piece of the overall public health puzzle. And so his point is that Americans are sort of doing things slightly backwards. We were hanging out, for example, in our homes, right? We were shutting down our economy, but then when we were going out in public, we weren't using masks because that wasn't part of our culture. And so his point was you could actually do a switch where you could have the economy be open, but have the very high prevalence of mask wearing, very high rates of hand washing, and you would probably actually get better results. And so I think, you know, part of what is so difficult about these conversations is that it's always a trade-off between economic and public health kinds of concerns. And there's a there, as you point out, there's a range of different options that different countries have taken, and some have chosen to keep their economies largely open. The situation in Sweden is obviously worth continuing to keep an eye on because they have so far avoided shutting down their economy, but that's also led to a dramatic rise in infections. So I think overall, I think Dr. Stone is correct. If you look at a lot of this has to do with general social norms within the communities that as those social norms already exist. And I do think that people were already making decisions before the state acted. I know, for example, I had a hair appointment that I canceled the week before any of this sort of went down because it was just there were people I think were getting uneasy about how close, how much it made sense to be in public, how much it made sense to be in close contact with other people. So I think, yes. So short answer, I think he's probably right.
All right. So listeners, we'd love to hear from you this hour. If you want to give us an email at connections@wxxi.org, are you satisfied with what governments at different levels have done to either mandate or guide behavior? Do you think it's gone too far? Is it wearing thin or do you think it's the right thing? You can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And let me turn to both of our guests for, sort of an interesting question that we've observed in New York State. You know, you have the question of gathering in playgrounds and parks. Now, parks are generally open, and Professor Cope, across the country, different states and different municipalities have made different decisions. A lot of them, not all, taken down basketball rims at playgrounds and whatnot. In this state, Governor Cuomo, during one of his briefings a couple of weeks ago, was saying that, you know, he really wanted to hold out and hope that, for example, in New York City, you know, you could walk down the street and not see the playgrounds filled with basketball games and filled with people congregating in close spaces. But he said, you know what, day after day, people kept doing it. So finally, government said, nope, we're taking the hoops down and we're closing off. We're going to tape over the playgrounds and we're going to say you can't do that because people didn't voluntarily behave in a way that would have been more conducive to public health. Does that sort of make sense to you? And do you think from what your research finds, the public would say, yeah, the governor's right on that. That was the right place for them to draw the line?
We didn't ask about those things specifically. You know, when we were starting to come up with these questions, we were trying to think of the most draconian or severe policies.
Sure.
And as soon as we put the survey in the field, the things that we were imagining, wouldn't happen were already talked about being happening, and then we'd wish that we'd asked about more substantial policies like requiring masks or, as you referred to, taking down basketball hoops and cordoning off playgrounds and so forth. But just anecdotally, as a citizen walking around, we still go to the parks and we're not allowed to have kids play on the playground, but we can, walk by them. And people do seem to be supporting this policy, especially when you mentioned playgrounds, when it comes to their kids, even though we know that children are relatively impervious to the virus compared with older people. I think that you'll get very few complaints about that.
Okay. Professor Hall, how do you feel about what the governor said when he said, look, we didn't want to have to take the rims down. We didn't want to have to tape over playground sites, but every day people were doing it, and we can't have that right now.
Yeah, I think particularly the outdoor spaces has been kind of interesting to watch. I think there was more recognition of the need to avoid, for example, crowded indoor spaces. But I think for a lot of people, that question of how dangerous it actually is to be out in the outdoors. And we also didn't have a lot of good research at the time about how long the virus, at least at the very beginning, about how long the virus could live on surfaces, as well as whether it was airborne for short periods of time and things like that. So I think I can understand why people were more laissez-faire in sort of the outdoor kind of area. I know in Pittsburgh, where I live, the supervisor had to close at least one town park because people were insisting on playing soccer. together. And so obviously there are people who are not following those orders. I do think, though, that that's a fairly small minority. When I see people out, as Professor Cope points out, I mean, the playgrounds are empty. People do not seem to be removing the tapes. People don't seem to be breaking those kinds of rules. So I do think that there is still a fair amount of support for that kind of measure. But I can also understand why that measure would feel different to people than, for example, the closing of restaurants and these more crowded, intimate spaces.
Yeah, and so let me follow that with asking you to kind of address what the governor said last week when he said, as I mentioned, to me it kind of rang like libertarian language when he announced this mandated masking while also saying, I can't make anybody do anything. You know, you have to do it because you know it's the right thing to do. And if you don't do it, you know, we don't want to see you in handcuffs. We want to see your fellow New Yorker shaming you. That'll be more effective than the state coming in and throwing you in jail. So if I were in the room, I would have said, Governor, I understand the logic you're saying there. But then for the New Yorkers who hear this and say, well, then why do you need a mandate? Why do you need to put the possibility of police power behind it? You know, I don't know that he's been asked that. I certainly want everyone wearing masks. I'm wearing masks everywhere I go. But what did you make of his language there, which kind of seemed to push back against the very idea of putting a state order in place?
Well, I think that there's trade-offs to all of these kinds of policies, and there's trade-offs to every single use of government power. So if you're putting especially local police into a position where they are forced to take an antagonistic approach to local citizens, and that's also an antagonistic approach that will then put them in close proximity to those citizens while they're arresting them, so there's a public health component to enforcing that kind of law. So I can understand what Cuomo is trying to do is take a moderate position of leading the way as a kind of moral political authority, saying we need to be masked in public. This is the right thing to do. But I just can't for probably economic but also public health reasons put the full weight of the state behind enforcing this kind of decree. And I think that's true in general of a variety of government policies, which is that if you enforce them to their most extreme, you end up in a kind of absurd situation, which is why government actors always have to be very careful about what exactly they are willing to enforce. So I actually think Cuomo made a very commonsensical kind of statement there.
Okay.
Evan, could I jump in for a second?
Yeah, please do.
And just build on what Professor Hall is saying. I think that she makes a lot of good points. I don't know. I didn't hear. I don't live in New York, and I haven't heard the statement you're referring to. If he's saying that the state doesn't have the legal power to enforce these things, that's probably not right. We understand that states probably do have the power to issue quarantines, to restrict travel, perhaps even to require people to wear masks, you know, so long as the restrictions have a reasonable basis. And so, you know, we know that other states have been citing people, maybe not putting them in jail, but certainly issuing violations and fines for it. And second, to build on what Professor Hall said, you know, the law, it doesn't just serve the purpose of enforcing or of coercing people into doing things by threat of jail or fines. It also has a normative role, which Professor Hall alluded to. So when the government, when the state says this is illegal to do, regardless of whether it's enforced or not, that can mobilize people around the norm that they shouldn't be doing that. And that can cause people to self-enforce on their fellow citizens. Whereas if the state said, it's okay, we're not going to criminalize that, just do it if you feel it's appropriate, or don't do it if you feel it's inappropriate, then the norm develops or continues that it's okay. So I think that there is a function for criminalizing something, for making it illegal, even if there isn't rigorous enforcement of it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly kind of the difference that the governor was trying to split in that news conference 8 days ago, where he essentially was saying, come on, guys, don't put us in a position where we feel like we have to do this. Like, this should be you. Like, we don't want to enforce any of these laws. And I think when he said, I can't make anybody change, what he's essentially saying is we can make laws. But if every citizen in New York decides I'm still going to work, I'm still going to the park, you know, come on. then there's not much that you can really do. I take your point, Professor Cope, on where you are, where the state may be legally. I think the governor was stating his preference for action without compelling force or action by the government. So I think he's trying to split a little bit of a difference. But let's see what our listeners think. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we'll get right back to your phone calls next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, telehealth has become the way that most people are seeing their doctors, at least during the pandemic. But there is a growing group in the medical profession who think that there will be some permanent changes, even after a vaccine, even after the pandemic, that there is some good that will come out of this, more efficiencies, maybe lower costs, quicker access to doctors. We're going to talk telehealth next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Fred in Rochester first up. Go ahead, Fred.
Yes, I work for a company that's still open because we're essential, considered essential. And on my commute back and forth to work, I work and live in the 14613 and 606 areas. And I see business as usual. People on the street, no masks, people going to convenience stores, in and out, people greeting in parking lots, shakes and hugs and even sharing cigarettes. I don't know what that mentality is. I'm 65 with respiratory issues, and I'm like, no, I'm not going anywhere near that spot.
Well, Fred, first of all, I appreciate the call and I appreciate the concern. I'm not going to minimize your experience at all. I will say that anecdotally, we got to be careful. I mean, I went to Abraham Lincoln Park in Webster for a hike last weekend. It was beautiful. And, everyone that I saw was kind of given a lot of space. But the first five people I encountered on the trails were not wearing masks. And I was thinking, that's a really surprising thing. I think the next 30 people I encountered were. So I ended up leaving thinking, oh, good, most people are. So I think, small sample sizes, we've got to be careful. But I do take the point that, that there's going to be places and moments where you don't feel that level of cooperation. And Professor Hall, what's an effective way to sort of handle that? He's saying, I'm staying away from that.
Yeah, I think a lot of this comes back to enforcing those social norms in a variety of ways. I know that actually a couple people I know went to Mendon Ponds Park and saw people without masks and people not, runners especially, not giving people adequate space. And I think in civil society, we absolutely have the right and the duty. It may not be a legal right or a legal duty in that sort of strict sense of the term, but as citizens, we have the right and duty to persuade our fellow citizens. And so letting people know that their behavior is unacceptable, that there are, in fact, various kinds of state mandates in place. Obviously, you have to be careful how you do that, because you certainly don't want to create a conflict that might be dangerous. But I think allowing people to educate their fellow citizens, and then I think there also is simply a leading by example kind of piece of this. So we have masks, our children have masks, and so on.
Yeah, and Professor Cope, you have pointed out that in the research that the team that you were a part of found, not only do many American citizens give a little bit of a pass to more of a crackdown on actual behavior right now, but the assumption is it's temporary. The assumption is we are not in a creeping authoritarian state. We are in an unusually extraordinary moment, and we are going to allow this, but for a short amount of time, right?
Right. We didn't ask them specifically how long they expected this to last. Excuse me. I kind of wish we had now, and I actually have a new survey with a different group that's talking about, that's asking people about whether they'd be willing to participate in certain trials and so forth, that where we are asking that. But I'm pretty sure that the temporary nature of these things, what people expect us to be back to normal as of March and a month or two, plays into it. If we had said that disease would last for several months or years, I think the response would be very different.
Okay. Deborah in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Deborah.
Hi. My family and I experienced something this week with my brother going into the hospital Sunday night. His wife thought he had a seizure.
I lost you, Deborah. Are you still there? Are you there, Deborah? No. Okay, let's do this. Deborah, give us a buzz back here, and we'll make sure we work in your story. Bonnie in Rochester next. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. yeah, I generally agree with what your guests are mainly saying. It is tricky, though, because, you know, you've got different people. I think there's also sometimes a racism kind of thing going where, you know, that people feel affronted because you're telling me where to sit, where to do this, where to do that. So you're going to have some of that. There's not like a perfect thing. But I want to point out a couple examples, though, locally. One of them is really difficult, and this is local but also statewide, is the use of when you depend on, and I underline that word, when you depend on public transportation. So that means you don't have a car. The grocery stores are not very near that easy to go to. So you have to use public transportation, i.e. the bus. And the bus is often got, in the very beginning of these discussions, got, at least in our area, got very little discussion. The transit authority did post some things, not masks at that point, but, you know, some, you know, be aware type of things. So even when they had, like, some public speaking meeting, they meeting the county executive and the mayor and stuff, they never had the Mr. Carpenter, who's head of the transportation system, present. I understand somebody told me he was, but you just couldn't see him on the screen. Well, and there was a recent Representative Borelli had an on-phone conference recently, and he wasn't there either. And that gives you a message that they don't know what to do, or that there's it's too difficult. And I use the bus. Of course, I use it much less now, as everybody. But there's a real thing going now where there's people that show some attitude about the use of limiting certain things, and they have started wearing masks, and it's too early maybe to say, but it's gotten to the point where a lot of people do wear the mask, but then, you know, some days there are fewer, and other days there's more. So the issue of enforcing comes up. And I think, you know, you always do want to avoid the kind of the hardest, I'm going to come in and arrest you type thing, although I was glad to hear the other person say that sometimes we should be using some of those things. But one of the things that I think would be helpful is that, especially after you get through the initial announcement that this is a major problem, is I understand that legislators and everybody wants to, you know, be home and not get exposed to this. But right now, there's almost no presence of elected officials anywhere. And at the transit center, I think it would be helpful if some of the city elected people would just work out a way to be over there sometimes and just be talking to people a little bit, further explaining. And I would suggest that, you know, some of the staff that are people of color, that might be better to do that, because the transit people are all white folks.
Well,
so, that's just the way you have to say it.
Yeah, so Bonnie, let me just jump in and say, first of all, I think the point that we need to see elected leaders, if they're going to say everyone go to the movies, and they're not necessarily saying that, though some are, then maybe they should be willing to go to the movies. Maybe they should be willing to ride the bus. I take that point. That's a separate discussion. Though I do want to bring Professor Cope in, because, you know, Bonnie is concerned that when you have extraordinary situations, that yes, the citizenry will say, okay, we're going to give the state a little bit more power to enforce here. But as you've pointed out, Professor, sometimes that has coincided with non-majority groups, vulnerable groups being targeted more than others.
That's right. And that's one major difference in what we see with these restrictions compared with some horror historical loss of liberty. If we think about the Cold War and the McCarthy era, and after 9/11 and restrictions, these were policies that targeted certain groups in general. So, you know, Islamic extremism after 9/11, in World War II, the Japanese internment camps, and so forth. And so, we can think about the gay rights movement in the 90s and the HIV epidemic. So these were discrete groups, and the government policies, you know, affected a small minority. And so there's a bit more concerning compared with the current environment, where if we pass a restriction that requires everyone to stay home or to close businesses, it affects everyone. Now, it doesn't affect everyone the exact same way. Bonnie's comment about mass transportation, you know, we see that the working class folks, lower middle class folks, African Americans, and perhaps Latinos are more likely to use public transportation in a lot of places in this country, and so they may be harder hit. But in general, everyone is affected by these. So when the population, when the citizenry decides that the measures have gone too far or they've gone on too long, then in a democracy, in theory, we have the ability to say, you know what, we're going to start rolling them back now. Whereas if they had targeted a discrete minority group, then they wouldn't have that power. So it's a little bit different dynamic.
Okay. Down to about our last 90 seconds, and as we've gone throughout the hour here, the amount of emails and phone calls is pretty remarkable. So listeners, if we didn't get your call or email, I promise you in a future conversation, we'll not only try to do that, but this is the kind of conversation that has to be ongoing because, as Professor Cope mentioned, they wanted to get a sense for what the American people are willing to tolerate at the outset of an extraordinary event like a pandemic, knowing that that's not a fixed position. And we will not only continue to evaluate what the government is telling us we must do or asking us to do, but what our preferences are. So 30 seconds apiece, I'll ask Professor Cope to what do you want to leave the audience with as we try to think about understanding what the public is willing to tolerate?
Well, you know, just that the public attitudes are very much a product of their time and of the threats to the security that people feel, and as such are very malleable. So if there's one thing that's bringing Republicans and Democrats together these days, although we may not always see it, it's this concern about this virus, which affects both Republicans and Democrats equally.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. The question of government action and also not drinking Lysol, bringing everybody together. Professor Hall.
Yeah, I'll just add to what Dr. Cope just mentioned, which is, I mean, I think also we're starting to see that a lot of these restrictions have been required because of previous government failures. And so other countries have been able to approach the situation very differently because they had adequate testing infrastructure in place. They had the ability to test people on a large scale. And so I think whenever we look at sort of how much the public is willing to tolerate, I think we're going to start seeing those comparisons come into greater relief.
I want to thank both of our guests for joining us this hour. And really interesting stuff, helping us understand where we are at this moment in time in this changing pandemic here. Kevin Cope, a professor of law and public policy at the University of Virginia School of Law, thank you very much for making time for the program.
Thanks, Evan.
And Lauren Hall, a professor of political science in the College of Liberal Arts at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Be well. Hope to talk to you soon, Professor.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, short break. More connections. That's what it's called. Still coming up.